get so excited about what I'm saying that I forget. My name is Emma Arubimbali. I have the great, great pleasure and privilege of being given the opportunity to convene this course, Who Are We? Shifting Identities in Post-Apartheid South Africa. And I really wanted to say thank you to Claire Kelly especially, but also to all of the people at Summer School who have been working really hard behind the scenes for the last, gosh, 6, 7, 8 months to make all of this happen. And I wanted to say thank you to all of you for being here, for finding something that kind of piqued your curiosity and getting yourself here. I really appreciate that as well. There's a couple of practicalities that I wanted to speak to you about very briefly before we carry on. I know that it's likely that we will have people filing in the back, unfortunately. We do did want to start on time, but apparently there's a bit of a backlog with picking up registration cards. And it is one of those times of evening with traffic and all sorts of other things and parking on campus, which might make it difficult for some people. So if we can make some allowance for that. I also wanted to let you know that all of the booksellers who are here during the daytime have a copy of this book, South African Keywords, which was the text that we thought would be a good accompaniment to this series of lectures, and it really does talk about a lot of the things that we will be speaking about this week in more depth and with different points of view, so it's a good resource to have. And last but not least, Professor Prah has asked if I could pre-circulate a document for the talk on Friday. So I'm going to send on a piece of paper. Only if you are willing to receive this one email from me do you put your name on your email address on that piece of paper. If you would like to get it some other way, come and speak to me. I will organize a way to get you a printout. I will never use that email for anything else ever in my life, I swear. I'll not sell it, use it for financial gain, etc., etc. So, but if you do want that, I'll pass this around. Please put your email address.
Yeah.
He has a paper that is about what he's speaking about on Friday that he wants people to have access to. So it's a PDF document that we will send to you. Yeah, thanks for asking. So, what are we doing this week? Well, we're going on a bit of an adventure. When we were thinking about this course, it could have been one person giving you a series of 5 lectures. But given that we're speaking about something this complex and this interesting, we thought one of the best ways of doing that would be getting a group of really extraordinary, creative, and different thinkers who come from different places, different disciplines, maybe different ways of looking at things, to speak to their own thinking and their own experience and their own questions about this topic. So really, we're scratching the surface of something that's probably far deeper. But I have the great and wonderful task of trying to help you thread some of these very different perspectives and opinions and ways of thinking and topics together this week into something that has some whole. Although I think that it might not be something where we get any answers, hopefully it will just raise more questions for us. And I wanted to just give you 2 kind of reference points around this issue of identities, right? Because that's really what we're asking, who are we? The one is a quote by my lovely husband, who usually uses the generic he for mankind, which I have a problem with. So I've changed it mildly, I've adapted him his common saying, which is that, you know, who we are is a summation of our history. The experiences that we've had, the conversations that we've had, the schools that we've been to, etc., etc., etc. We are, as individuals, a gathering of those experiences. But those experiences don't happen in a vacuum, right? And Stuart Hall points a little bit to this when he says identities are the names that we give to the ways that we are positioned by and position ourselves within the narratives of the past. Now, when he's talking narratives, he's not just talking stories, right? He's doing, you know, you could consider that racist thinking is a narrative, a view of the world. It's a story about who people are and how people should be. if you're white, you should be like this. If you're black, you should be like this. In South Africa, if you're colored, you should be like this. But those stories don't just exist in the realm of stories. They have a real impact, a material impact, in the way that our society is structured and created. And it is inside that structure that we get born into and grow up inside of and try to navigate and try and find out who we are in relation to those broad social stories. So we are often quite determined to some degree by the environment into which we're born. If you were born in a different time, in a different country, a different gender, a different race, your experience and your identity would likely be very different. Not because those things and those categories are different, but because the world that we live in has stories about how those things are different, and those stories influence who we are. All right? Following, I'm getting some nods and some stares. So, but it's something that we'll explore a little bit more as the week goes on. But just to kind of, that's the frame that you're in. So we're not talking about fixed things that exist in reality. We're talking about the kinds of stories that we tell about these categories of race, gender, sexuality, class, and all of those things. Right? And that's the perspective that we're coming from. And hopefully what all of these extraordinary thinkers and lectures will do is give us a whole different set of lenses or their own perspectives and ways of actually looking at some of these things. All right. Any questions?
I just want to speak about a mild discomfort that I have with this definition. After positioning ourselves with a narrative of the past,
yes,
I would like to add, and the present.
I've always thought that. You're so spot on. Narratives change. We live in a country where our narrative has changed, although we must recognize that our past narrative is something that we inherit and carry with us and are still living with as well as the changing narratives that we are in. Thank you very much.
Perfect.
I think that's what I'm going to leave you with as we start today. One last point. All of these things that we're talking about this week is to say we cannot be reduced as human beings to any of these categories, although society likes to do that a lot. Right? So there are common stories that we tell like to reduce us to just woman, just white, just black, just queer, just straight. And we're not that. We are a mix of all of those things. So try and pull those things apart as well as we go through this week. All right. The people that I didn't thank yet are all of the extraordinary thinkers and speakers that will be holding the space for you for the rest of the week. And I have the extraordinary privilege of introducing Professor Ndebele to you for this evening's session. I think many of you know who he is, but just a brief summary in case you don't. He's a noted academic and author, writer of several books, including the novel The Cry of Winnie Mandela, including the very touchstone book, Rediscovering of the Ordinary. His career spans a range of academic and public offices, including at some point in time the Vice Chancellor of this university, so we're very glad to have him back from that interview. And from 2012, the Chancellor of the University of Johannesburg. He contributes regularly and widely to public discourse in South Africa. He has 11 honorary doctorates, many awards, and a huge career of distinguished public service. One of the things that I most love is the vision that he co-created for the National Planning Commission's Vision 2030, which is about imagining the kind of future that we want as South Africans, and I think it's an extraordinarily powerful piece of work. So, mostly what I think he's going to be doing, because they all responded very openly to this brief, they're going to be deciding how and what they cover on their own terms, but to look at acknowledging who we are, where we've come from, and imagining a potential future. So, Professor Ndebele, I'm handing over to you. Thank you very much.
All right. Good afternoon to you all, and thank you, Emma, for kind words of introduction. Thank you for coming to this lecture this afternoon. I've called it the coming out of the mask, or coming from out under the mask. And I'll explain as we move along what I mean by that, and the subtitle of Shifting Identities in Post-Apartheid South Africa, which is the name of the series. We are in the, as South Africans, the 20th year of our liberation since 1994. And a great deal has happened since then. Perhaps one of the things that have happened that are very germane to this discussion today is that we just lost Madiba, who was very much there in 1994, and very much a beacon for us, pointing the direction. And it is remain to ask, after his departure, who have we been and who are we going to be now? Because there was a sense of comfort about his presence, and a sense of disturbance as well, because there were a lot of people, there were many reactions towards him. There were those who were willing to let go, that we all start our lives and then they end at some point, and it's a natural thing to do. And there are others who would have wanted him to live forever. And there are, for different reasons, there are those who would have wanted him to live forever because in his presence, their proximity to him can be a source of legitimacy for a lot of things that can be done that make a lot of sense and many that don't. Mm-hmm. So he's gone and we are faced with ourselves. I think that is one of the things that is significant. And we have come a long way from 1994. And we have seen a lot of people come to live in South Africa from places we never imagined before as South Africans. Many we have forgotten have actually come from a so-called Eastern Europe. Bulgaria, Romania, and all those countries, they trooped in, I can use the expression, just before 1994, when things opened up with the demise of the Berlin Wall. But since 1994, it's wonderful how many Africans from other parts of the continent have come in large numbers to South Africa. And they live in different places. And they have changed the way we feel, we think about who we are in very important ways. Many other things have happened about the provision of amenities to people, housing, water, sanitation, schooling, numbers of pupils going to school, graduating from university, have increased tremendously. We are no longer who we were now. We are not now who we were in 1994. And that is something to ponder, because I have come to this talk thinking that many of us in here, if you are South African, is wanting to know about the how we are evolving towards some identity, if you can call it that, that we don't know who, how to characterize. So the questions that have been asked just before are very relevant. I'd like to begin with the proposition, and it is that to assert that there is not a single South African in here who was born in this country or came from somewhere to live in it as a child into adulthood, who can claim to have a pure identity. So a little more about that. You may have been born an Afrikaner, for example, but are you really that only? Or are you a Zulu only? Or are you Jew or Muslim only? Black or white? Are you that only? Male or female? Do you come from Qiba? I don't know Qiba. I didn't know Qiba before this, because what I did as I was preparing for this lecture, I opened an atlas and put my pen, and it landed on Qiba. It's somewhere in the Eastern Cape. I just discovered just below the more well-known place called Elliot. It's very much in the rural areas. But do you come from there or Johannesburg? Are you from there only? Even if you may have been born and lived there all your life, but are you really from there only? Are you South African only? I think that if these questions assert something about which certitude of some kind can be claimed or affirmed. I am male, for example, so it might seem as if there is some certitude to that, because all of you look at me and you must be a male, of course. And it seems clear, but the questions may also introduce doubt about that kind of certitude. If I am male and I am that only, could you or could I as male, for example, be female also in some interesting ways? And I'm not talking about gay people. And could you as white be black also, and the other way around? And I'm not talking here about people we know in South Africa as coloreds. I'm talking about reference was made to a book that I wrote, The Cry of Nelson Mandela, which I started writing about 1996 and published it about 10 years later, when for much of that time I was both male and female writing it, because people who have read that novel, some have cynically said to me, "Are you sure your wife didn't write it?" But it is a reality about, it is something about being something or somebody else from the extent to which you are able to project into someone and live that life beyond what you have heard about that person, but become that person in ways that make you more than who you are or who you have received yourself to be. And that is a difficult thing to do about being South Africans today. I will tell a story. I'm sorry, this lecture constrains me, but I will tell you a story about a nun. 62 years ago, who was brutally killed in the Eastern Cape. Her name is Sister Quinlan. She came from Ireland to work in South Africa in the 40s. And she began to, she decided that she wanted to do, she's a Dominican nun. And she decided that she wants to do, to become a gynecologist. And she then began to study as a nun, as a doctor, at the University of the Witwatersrand, where she graduated, according to the record, becoming the very first nun to graduate as a doctor, if that is correct, but that's what the record says. Anyway, she went to live in the Eastern Cape, and the village of Duncan village is where she went. Her killing happened in Duncan village in the township of East London. A riot erupted in the wake of the ANC defense campaign of the time, in a massive protest against the hated pass laws. When Sister Quinlan graduated as a medical doctor at the University of the Witwatersrand, it was to be the first time in history that a sister was kept a doctor. On the 9th of November in 1952, she found herself, as the expression goes, at the wrong place and at the wrong time, but not according to her. She was and died where she had to be. So it wasn't the wrong place and the wrong time for her. A police roadblock failed to stop her going into the restive township. Her people, she insisted, needed her. It is understandable why she trusted, she felt these were her people. Hadn't she delivered countless numbers of their babies? Hadn't she prayed with them a countless times? Wasn't her regular presence in the township a part of its social landscape? But not on that day. A mob of young protesters stopped her car and reportedly dragged her out, stoned her, burnt her body and her car. As if that was not enough horror, some of them cut off a part of her flesh to eat it. So there she was, born in Ireland, to die horrifically in South Africa. 26 years later, a similar event took place in Soweto, June 16, 1976. Dr. Melville Edelstein. White, according to the definition of people by the state, was well known in Soweto, but he was killed by young people that he loved. It is said that a sociologist, Dr. Edelstein, worked closely with many youth from Soweto. Earlier on that fateful morning, he greeted students as they passed his house in Soweto on Mputi Street. However, once news of Hector Peterson's death filtered through the ranks, happiness turned to anger, and Dr. Edelstein was murdered for being a white man in the wrong place at the wrong time. Ironically, Dr. Elderstein had warned that the hostility of township youth should be taken as a serious threat to peace in Soweto. In his thesis, written 5 years prior to the events of June 16, entitled What Young Africans Think, he indicated that 73% of the youth interviewed listed inadequate political rights among major grievances. And you will remember then that the major issue that triggered 1976 was that the government decided that the language of instruction for everyone in the township was going to be Afrikaans. And that triggered it. And so this is what happened then to the person that loved the people that killed him. He was stoned to death by the students and left with a sign around his neck proclaiming, "Beware Afrikaners, you asked for it." And it is signed a small letter K A F F E R S, Kefas. It is spelled in that way. So we're killing this person, and we sign it according to the way that you want us to use this language. We are the Kafirs who have signed it. These are dramatic events. But I'd like to juxtapose the killing of Sister Quinlan with another killing. Chris Hani, as we know, was assassinated on the 10th of April in 1993 in the suburb of Boksburg. He was accosted by a Polish far-right immigrant named Janusz Walus, who shot him in the head and at the back as he stepped out of his car. The assassin fled the scene. Someone recalls hearing that he was arrested soon afterwards. On April 13, I watched, as many other South Africans, a television confirmation of the arrest and heard an unforgettable Nelson Mandela addressing the nation about an event that he called a watershed moment for all of us. I asked myself, who? It was clear from his message what he meant by us. And this is a remarkable thing. I'm still even reading it today. Tonight, he began, "I am reaching out to every single South African, black and white, from the very depths of my being. A white man," he said, "full of prejudice and hate, came to our country and committed a deed so foul that our whole nation now tenders on the brink of disaster. A white woman of Afrikaner origin risked her life so that we may know and bring to justice this assassin." It is a very well crafted and mentions all the signposts that South Africans will remember, will black, white, Afrikaner, you know, and so on. Brings them all together, and with a devastating logic prevents a situation where we will fall into different camps and kill one another just from by looking at who you are. The logic of it, that a white person killed a black person and a white woman, an Afrikaner, reported the white man who was arrested. You can't then go out there and kill everyone, because the logic of it is devastating. And it is this ability then to put a crisis in such a graphic manner that the graphic manner itself renders a solution that prevents a racial catastrophe. So we have Sister Quinlan on one hand and Chris Hani on the other. She was a Christian and he was a communist. I'm about to make a statement about both of them that may come across as unacceptable to some. It is this, that we have in these two individuals are people who were killed by those they loved. Now, it is a statement easier to accept for Sister Quinlan and Dr. Edelstein, but harder to accept for Chris Hani, because it is to be supposed that he didn't like the likes of the person that killed him. That's what we might think. But it is highly likely that Chris Hani did not approach the world from the Christian perspective of Sister Quinlan. But it is also likely that even as a communist, he shared the Christian objective to make the human condition in the world better. Freedom for all peoples in the world is the true and shared dream of all people. I also do have an enormous respect for the intellectually rigorous communist critiques of society in the tradition of Marx, Lenin, Engels, Mao Zedong, Amilcar Cabral, among other thinkers, in their quest for a world free of the oppression and the exploitation of people by other people. That is why in the anti-colonial struggles of the 1960s and the 1970s, they spoke to the hearts and minds of oppressed people the world over. So Chris Hani, by definition, belonged to these traditions and accepted them. The fact that he and his comrades may have been demonized in the same way that Nelson Mandela was demonized as a terrorist does not diminish the inherent dignity of their vision. So he may have articulated a love, may not have articulated a love for people in quite the same way that Sister Quinlan did in her Christian manner. But he can at least be said to have said so in principle, loved all people, including Janusz Walus, from the perspective of a communist vision for freedom and justice for all people in the world. So what we have is three remarkable people who died, according to my formulation, were killed by those they loved, whether they declared that love or expressed it in principle. They had, in their own individual ways, a longing for the universality of human freedom. But Janusz Walus and the killers of Sister Quinlan and Edelstein are not that easy to equate, actually. The killers of Quinlan and Edelstein acted on impulse. Walus, on the other hand, planned this killing almost meticulously, while the individuals in the mob are amenable to regret, hindsight. It is inherently difficult to accept any expressions of regret from Walus Janusz without his having to work harder and harder over time for us to actually believe him. Janusz Walus has to put in a lot more work for us to believe that he regrets, precisely because he spent a great deal of time planning the murder or the assassination. It is difficult for us not to dismiss a lot of his reasoning as rationalizations and justifications of one sort or another. We may, in the goodness of our hearts, listen to him make his plea, but we reserve the right to accept or not to accept. But this does not change the perspective from which Chris Hani may have viewed him from a universal perspective. I think that there are more people in South Africa who have lived in the psychology of the mob as a group, and yet as individuals are more likely to become more sincere about what they actually felt that is not consonant with the mob or group sensibility. We have people in this country, Beyos Nodier, for example, who grew up within, not different from a mad mob mentality, in which people are mobilized in a particular way to achieve particular defined objectives in a planned and systematic way, that it is impossible to not to see then the influence of the mob psychology, which is different from what happens to the mob instantly, but because the mob mentality I'm talking about, which all of us became subject to, is constructed over years. So whereas the children saw someone and killed them at that particular moment, the mobs of a society are built over time. In my case, in our case, I was born in 1948. So I am a child of the year that apartheid began. And so for the whole time that I was there, I was being fashioned into a particular kind of person, as many of us were, that over time you just look at me and you make a decision about who I am, what I'm supposed to, where I'm supposed to be, and so on. Over time, it becomes easier and easier to kill and maim such people because you have already written them off in the day-to-day life. So between the mob and the race, the mob and class, and the mob and gender, and the mob and religion, the mob and nationality, the mob and the social climate, it is all a matter of degree, but subject to the same forces. So the people killed both Sister Quinlan and Melville were young. We saw this phenomenon of youthful executioners in the necklace killings in Soweto in the 1970s and in the 1980s. Today, we also, in the so-called service deliveries, we see them almost daily on television, burning, throwing stones at times when they should be at school. We should also remember, too, that many of the white soldiers in Soweto were as old as those that they killed. And that such events and their dramatis personae evoked a depth of emotion impossible to ignore, because these are young people. What is the future in store for them? Some years ago, I observed about such events. They speak to the emergence of an identity with social values embedded in it that will in time solidify into memories of cultural practice, which can be both a blessing and a curse, that predispose us to replicate our values and social practices wherever we are in the world. Unintended and left to linger without deliberate attention, they sneak into the DNA of a new society as a blessing or a curse. I'm trying to draw some meaning from these stories, and as I hope you're doing so. And I'll probably tell one more story. You will all remember in, I think it was in 2006 or 7 or thereabout, the events at the University of the Free State, where the young people again played a trick, young Afrikaners, we were told, played a trick on elderly women who worked in domestic labor of one thing or another, making life easy for the young people in the residences, and they played this trick on them, and which culminated in some ritual in which it has never been conclusively proved that whether in fact they made them drink this urine or they didn't. But I've always wondered, how come that these kids who were in their late teens or maybe early 20s, where did they pick up this ability to do such a thing? Because many of them would have been young babies in 1994. Where did they get it from? Is it from home? Is it from church? Is it from traditions inside the university that may have been unknown to their parents or to their churches or whatever? But because they come in and they find these practices, in order to become socialized, to become a student, you have to do these things. And then you become accepted. So in order to graduate, and it's like if you are asked in some gang or something, that in order to become a part of this gang, you must prove your courage and go and murder somebody. So they have to do that. And humiliate these women, and then get a prize for having done so successfully. I'm thinking about 1994. I'll try and pull everything to that. Thinking about 1994. When we decided that we were going to vote in 1994, we decided to do one thing together for the first time in the history, in the 300 years of contemporary South African history, there's one thing that we all decided we want to do, to go and vote and participate in an electoral system. It's unforgettable, those pictures, when you still see them today, they still inspire if you look at them. I have looked back into our history and tried to say, was there some other moment when we ever did anything like that? I can't find it, except that we did cooperate in many ways in the building of the economy, in the workplace, in the mines, in the factories, in the shops, in our own homes. that the general trend in the relationship was a master and servant relationship. So there we were in 1994, master, servant, teacher, priest, Afrikaner, Zulu, whatever. We're in that queue, and there was only one identity at that time, the identity of voting people. And we had this wonderful election, and we elected a government, and the parliament began its work. Madiba was made the president, and they say the rest is history. My talk is about masks, coming out from under the masks. I think that when we did that, we performed an historic symbolic act of creating something. Like all masks, particularly African masks that I'm using as a reference point, you have this mask that is supposed to be put over the head of a person, and that person becomes the embodiment of the spirit which that mask is supposed to represent. And that mask puts across an unambiguous message. If it is the face of terror, that's what you see. If it is the face of a loving, kind spirit, that's what you see. The creators of those masks do whatever they can to ensure that when you look at the mask, you get its message. I have seen some particularly dramatic masks where people, where you know that in instances in Malawi, where they were using the masquerades to put across messages about AIDS, and you see these people, they're wearing these masks and they're dancing to the throbbing rhythms of drums, and when they approach people, these people know that these are just masks. And sometimes there are even people who are wearing this mask that they know. But at that particular moment, they evoke such terror that people bolt away from them. And that is the power of the mask. But the mask comes across as a ritual. That you've got to go beyond the fear. You've got to remember the ritual and then think about what it actually meant for you in your day-to-day lives. So there we were, the lines of voting were a tremendous ritual. And on that day, we put away our masks of centuries of suspecting one another. And we agreed on that particular day that we are going to do one thing to start creating a nation. But we would have made a big mistake if you thought that just by voting on that day together, you have solved the problems of South Africa. In fact, the challenge begins at that very moment. So the stories that I have shared with you are stories about being put in a situation which when you look at it on itself, sends out a very clear and unambiguous message. These, depending on who you are, these black kids who killed Sister Quinlan, you can read some of the newspapers, it's typical of black people. That's what they do, savages. Or you can be embarrassed as a person who lives in that community. Perhaps you know those kids. You have seen them, you have interacted with them. They are far from the savage in someone else's mind. The boy next door, who can't explain why he was there when somebody got killed. And so, 6 years later, the people of East London decided, that's how I got to know about this story. I received an invitation. Please come and speak at this event. We are commemorating the death of someone who was killed 60 years ago, and we are ashamed, and we want to remember and atone. And we've got to embrace this person that died under such horrible circumstances. It shouldn't have happened, but it did. So there was I, terrified by this. What was I going to say about this? So I read and read and read and discovered her. I gave my talk on it, and you'll find it on my website. If you go to jabulondebele.com. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that here was another opportunity for me to enter a situation that I had never been in. And that in my reflections on this event, I accepted that these boys were a part of me, and I can't say that I am not involved somehow in that. And there was the community that said, we want to distance ourselves from what happened, but we accept some of us lived during that time. That is how it was. So, about shifting identities, how many of us then are prepared to confront what's inside of themselves as being critical in changing the public space out there? Are you afraid to condemn an action by some black person somewhere because you think that by doing so you will be labeled a racist? So you walk away. You walk away from something that appalls you, and you keep quiet about it. Or if you are black, are you prepared to take a stand against people that you have supported in a political sense, who are now in government and are doing things that don't make absolutely no sense? So you decide to look away because you've always been comrades at arms, you know, together. What does it take for us in this changing identities? Remember that if you are no longer who you were in 1994, what are you now? Are you part of the silence? Are you prepared to make known to the world what is inside of you? Because it will make a difference to others. I think that most South Africans have turned their backs to the past, from to the past, but they don't have a language to talk about the future, because they haven't sorted out relationships between themselves in situations that are required to be confronted and not turned away from. So only in that context do you redefine the public space as a place of honesty and truth and giving witness of what is inside and putting it out there in the public domain. You will find others there who are doing the same, and to redesign the public spaces in South Africa for the better. So changing identities are not about looking at something happening out there, but about being involved in the process of redefining ourselves. And it always begins inside, with the courage to be able to take a stand. I don't think that any South African is absorbed from the responsibility to take that stand. I was shown the clock, so I better stop at this point.
Thank you very much, Mpumelelo. Thank you for your words. It was very, very hard to show the clock. I was deeply involved in what you were saying. It does mean, though, that we have very, very few moments for questions, and so I'm going to limit questions or comments to three. I'm really sorry about that. I'll try and make sure that people who stick up their hands today have chances throughout the week to say something. Is there anybody with anything burning that they want to release? Comment you'd like to say? Yes. Okay, let me just check the 1, 2. Any other takers? No. Okay,
yes.
I just wanted your email address, please.
Could
you spell it out?
My
it's
email address.
The website address.
Oh. It's
Njabulo
Ndebele.
Absolutely. It's Prof's name.
It's my name.
Name and last name and .co.za.
Okay, you can write it down.
And Prof will correct me if I'm... This is your dossier, this is your...
Yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. I assume that most of you are Zulus already.
We talk about very violent things that happened in the past, and they're all very really true. But what I find very alarming is they're going on. If you look at Marikana, if you look at Prince, if you look at things, so how do we deal with that? Because it's not stopping.
So she's asking, there was violence, and we've spoken about violence in the past, but what about the violence of our present? What about Marikana? What about the things that are going on in our society today? Right.
Yes, I was making really a statement about, I think those things are going on, and it's terrible, but there's a lot of other things as well that are going on that are very positive. But the point that I was trying to make in my presentation is that we are now living in beyond 1994, a highly interactive space. So even when we sense that there is a muzzling, an attempt to muzzle the press, an attempt to interfere with the judiciary, or even when the pictures of Mkandla, they get us angry, you know. But it is an interactive space. So in an interactive space, you create opportunities for solutions to emerge. But it doesn't end there. It means that people have inherent weaknesses that we create institutions in order to help them along. So So you have the legal system, you have the police system, you have the schooling system, everything that those, you tend to those things when all else fails, to remind us of the path that has to be taken to the future. So yes, there's marijuana, yes. The question is, why does marijuana continue to happen? I think it partly happens because we haven't, in the new dispensation, owned the institutional environment that was created on the basis of the Constitution. There are some people who find that the constitutional dispensation an encumbrance. So, can you consider this, just one example. A decision was made that we are not going to have we are going to demilitarize the police force. We are no longer going to have generals and all colonels and lieutenants and all of those things. But it happened on just with the flip of a switch. We got the generals back, and the generals don't talk, they shoot. So that is the problem, that it has been some of the things that we do tell the story that we have shifted away from the objective of a visionary objective of creating a human space. You can deal with criminals by shooting them, or you can create institutions that change their course. But if you decide to shoot them, you won't stop with shooting them. You will shoot other people as well. And then it goes on and on and on in a spiral. It's got to stop somewhere. And I think part of the failure of post-1994 is that we didn't use the institutions to stop something. Instead, we thought that we could go back to what we are good at. If it was done to us, we can now do it to others as well. And I think that is the problem, partly.
Do you mind coming? Maybe Prabhupada could take questions after I'm just very aware of time and that people do need to leave. I think perhaps just to say one of the things about taking from what Prabhupada said, often we relate with each other on the basis of the stories that we've heard about who that person is. That's another part of the way that we interact with each other, that mob mentality that we have. And the stories that we tell in our public sphere, the stories that we read in our newspapers here on our TVs, that we base our ideas about these people on, are not the full story of who these people are. And I think that's one of the things about transforming, about shifting identities, is actively going out and finding the stories that are not told, that we don't hear. And I know that there are people in this room who do that work, so thank you for being here. Maybe you can share over the next couple of days. Thank you very much for your time. I'm sure Prabhupada might take one or two questions, and we'll see you tomorrow.